watches I ride in this wind. On my good horse I call you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WUS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Describing the United States of the 1830s in his now famous work, Democracy in America, the young French aristocrat Alexis de Tocqueville depicted a country passionate about self-governance. In the 50 years since sovereignty had passed from the crown to the people, citizens of the new republic had seized upon every opportunity to, quote, take a hand in the government of society and to talk about it. If an American should be reduced to occupying himself with his own affairs, wrote de Tocqueville, half his existence would be snatched from him. He would feel it as a vast void in his life. At the center of that vibrant society was the town or county government. Without local institutions, de Tocqueville believed, a nation has not got the spirit of liberty and might easily fall victim to despotic tendencies. In that era's burgeoning textile and railroad industries and in its rising commercial class, de Tocqueville had already detected a threat to the, quote, equality of conditions he so admired in America. The friends of democracy should keep their eyes anxiously fixed, he warned, on an industrial aristocracy, for if ever again permanent inequality of conditions make their way into the world, it will have been by that door that they entered. Under those conditions, he thought, life might very well be worse than it had been under the old regimes of Europe. The old land-based aristocracy of Europe at least felt obliged to come to the help of its servants and relieve their distress. But the industrial aristocracy, when it has impoverished and brutalized the men it uses, abandons them in a time of crisis. Close quote. As de Tocqueville predicted, the industrial aristocrats have prevailed in America. They have garnered enormous power over the past 150 years through the inexorable development of the modern corporation. Having achieved extensive control over so many facets of our lives, from food and clothing production to information, transportation, and other necessities, corporate institutions have become more powerful than the sovereign people who originally granted them existence. The result, say thinkers from a nascent green populist movement, is that we live in a democracy theme park in which citizens are allowed to engage in the trappings of democratic decision-making, but are unable to prevail under law when their desires come into conflict with the profit-making schemes of the corporate few. The rule of law is, in fact, corporate rule, a government of the corporate class, by the corporate class, for the corporate class. If you're poor, and especially poor and a person of color, you probably have few illusions about who wields the law against whom. But something interesting has been happening in rural central Pennsylvania, in communities inhabited by mostly conservative white homeowners and landowners, the sort of voters who elect politicians who tout law and order and who value the notion of being law-abiding and hard-working. What these citizens discovered, and not for the first time in American history, is that when the law comes to your door, it comes as a bagman for corporate America, and that you have no rights that any corporation is bound to respect. CELDEF, a group of public interest lawyers working on environmental justice issues in central Pennsylvania, came face to face with the realization that breaking out of the democracy theme park was a real issue. Based on their experiences fighting factory farms and other toxic industries, they initiated Democracy School, an intensive weekend course designed to help local communities invigorate those local institutions of which de Tocqueville wrote. What began in central Pennsylvania is spreading, and last week, New York State's first democracy school was held here in the Finger Lakes. I was there, and through the magic of radio, I am pleased to present the first of a three-part series on Democracy School with Thomas Lindsay of CELDEF, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. Thomas Lindsay.
My name is Tom Lindsay. I'm an attorney with a law firm in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. I'm going to talk about a little about our work and specifically my own evolution, because I didn't drop from Mars either. I've started out doing regulatory work within a legal framework and have morphed and evolved to something a little more dangerous that recently almost got us in trouble with some courts and litigation, and we'll talk about that as well. This is the 53rd democracy school that's been taught. 53 democracy schools over a period of 2.5 years. 2.5 years ago, we started at Wilson College in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, with folks calling us from out of state saying, hey, we've heard something's going on in Pennsylvania. We want to learn what it is. And we would spend 4 or 5 hours a week talking with folks on the phone who wanted to replicate what was happening in Pennsylvania into other parts of the country. And we started getting a little pissy about having to spend that much time on the phone with folks trying to explain what was happening. And somebody much smarter than us, obviously, suggested that we start a school. And we said, well, do you think anybody would come? And they said, well, we don't know, but why don't you try it? And so we did. And the first school at Wilson College, which was about 2.5 years ago, drew five people. Five people from five different states, which was fairly unusual. We had people flying from Oregon and California. And from those small beginnings, a five-person class in rural south-central Pennsylvania, we now have 15 permanent locations that are teaching between 4 and 6 schools a year. We have about 150 people waiting to get into the schools, which floors me. You know, you start with five people, and now there's 150 people trying to get into the schools. Richard Grossman, who teaches quite a few of these schools with me, always says that everything's in the opening. That everything is said that we're going to get into in the democracy school stuff. Wanted to be upfront with folks at the beginning. We don't have a silver bullet. I mean, it's not like we do a democracy school and all of a sudden, I know, I'm leaving too. There's no package that we can give you that's automatically something that you can just put in the chamber and then everything's okay. This is about unraveling. Richard Grossman in early stage called it psychological demolition. Because what we found is not only is our organizing colonized, and the way that we go about things is predictable. And in fact, it's a script that's not written by us. It's written by someone else, and we follow it. Gleefully, sometimes we follow it. But it's our brains that are colonized. Because we censor ourselves about what's possible and what's not possible. Who has the authority to do things? Who has the authority to make decisions on behalf of communities? And all those really good things that we never have a safe space to talk about. That's what democracy school is about. It's basically creating that safe space to explore this stuff. It's going to be stuff this weekend that you look at and you say, we can't do that. We don't have the authority to do that in our community. In fact, there's this law and this law, and there's this case and this case, and we're told that this is a normal farming operation, or, you know, and so we can't do that. Well, it's time to let all that stuff go, because in Pennsylvania, people are saying, who has the right to define that stuff? Other than us. Who has that right? And what kinds of exciting energy liberation takes place when people start to aim at the real stuff instead of the regulatory stuff and the energy sink that it is most of the time? And people start aiming at the real stuff. Richard Grossman, like I said, is usually here to talk about his evolution. I'm going to talk a couple minutes about that, and then a couple minutes about my evolution, then turn over to Vicki, and then we're going to run through the curriculum materials and then close up for the night. Richard, back in 1994, likes to tell the story about how 13 gray hairs came together to form a group called the Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy, what folks know as the acronym POCLAD, Program on Corporations, Law, and Democracy. It's essentially Richard, an individual named Peter Kalman from Maine, who's now the president of the Southern Maine Labor Council. A woman named Jane Ann Morris, who calls herself a corporate anthropologist. She actually does house painting during the day in Wisconsin. That they came together and they asked themselves some really difficult questions. Like, we've been doing activist work for the past 20 years, but things have been getting worse, not better. After we've mobilized thousands of people, some of the folks in Popad were elected city council members, active with organized labor, shop stewards, in the environmental community, presidents and executive directors of nonprofit organizations working on environmental issues. So they asked themselves, why are things getting worse? After we've mobilized people, after the communities have become active. In the environmental field, we ask ourselves the same question, right? After 30, 40 years of organizing, literally hundreds of millions of dollars being raised, at least hundreds of thousands, millions of permits being appealed by different groups, that almost by every statistic, environmentally, things are worse now than they were before. Okay. What's wrong with that picture? Okay. That folks have been doing that work for so long that things have been getting worse. And so these folks that came together to ask themselves those really tough questions, this POPLAT organization, started looking at the corporation because they figured it was a good place to start because a lot of their permit appeals were against corporations. A lot of the labor organizing was done against corporations. A lot of the environmental work was done against corporations. And they figured that the corporation really is the dominant institution of our time. Okay? In a words used in a brief, a legal brief that was just filed by a big corporation that were that we sued, was that challenging the power and authority of corporations in this country is like unraveling a critical socioeconomic fabric within this country.
It sure is.
Contesting the power is about damaging, in their words, infringing and ripping apart that fabric.
It's family values.
It's family values, mm-hmm. Yes. So when they start to look at the corporation, just like when you pull a thread off your lapel and it starts unraveling other things, like the thread that unravels everything, the looking at the corporate form and the corporate chartering process and what corporations used to be after the American Revolution, where did corporations come from? Who runs corporations? Okay. What is the deal with corporations and why do they have rights and powers that essentially enable them to be governing institutions? Governing institutions. Okay? The phrase was used around the table a couple minutes ago about a corporate system. Okay? Now, when you look at the corporation, the reason why it's connected to everything else is because it's a system. Just like the slave system that we had in this country at one time. It wasn't just slavery that we had in this country. A private relationship between slave owners and slaves. And by the way, when the slave owners whipped the slave and the slave called the sheriff, who did the sheriff arrest when he arrived on the scene? It was the power of being a slave owner backed by law. Backed by law and backed by the enforcement might of the nation. We forget that the U.S. Constitution enabled slavery. The bonded labor clause that was within the Constitution. The three-fifths clause, which allowed Southern property owners to essentially elect a majority to Congress. That's why the first presidents were from the South. Okay? We forget some of those things. We forget that the Fugitive Slave Act, which was based on that return of bonded labor clause in the U.S. Constitution, was paid for by tax monies for taking back fugitives who escaped from slavery into the northern states. That's what the Fugitive Slave Act did. It's based on the Constitution, based on constitutional provisions. So we talk about usurping the Constitution, you get into a very sticky place. Because in some ways, the program Corporations, Law, and Democracy began to see a lot of similarities between the slave system and the corporate system. Turns out that the slave system, which was controlled by a relatively few handful of folks, not just in the South, but also in the North, we forget that Northern merchants made a lot of money off the slave trade and backed financially the Southern slave owners and plantation estates. Okay? That there were commonalities between the two systems because when the slave system was broken apart in Reconstruction and after the Civil War, a lot of those same folks drove the corporation into the Constitution after the Civil War to become their primary mechanism of governance. It didn't need the corporation before the Civil War because they had the slave system. After the Civil War, they drove themselves into the Constitution to protect the corporation with some of the same powers that the U.S. Constitution protected the slave system with. That's a pretty scary history. It took me a number of years to come to grips with that. Because I needed to see the data. I'm a data person. You know, you can tell me all you want, but lo and behold, there's some histories that track the large slave owners into companies like Woolrich and some of the Civil War corporations that made armaments. I mean, it's a fascinating history. We're not going to go into it here. Richard has this chart, and the chart has two lines on it. And one is the rights of people. It's over 250 years of this country's history. One is the rights of people, and it goes up and down, you know, as people gained rights and lost rights. The other part is the rights of the few. Okay? The corporate few is what's reflected in his chart. But eventually, Popeye came to a point where they said, well, slave system, corporate system, there's something much more fundamental happening here. This is all about the few governing the many. About the few making governing decisions that allow them to trump what the many want. In other words, that's the system that we have. It's reflected in the slave system and the corporate system stuff. When you go back and look at the Constitution, as these folks did, they saw that the Constitution was about the few governing the many. We forget that, perhaps we don't forget, that 80% of the people were not people when the Constitution was drafted. Women weren't at the table. Indentured servants weren't at the table. Slaves weren't at the table. White men without property weren't at the table either. They weren't considered persons. We forget sometimes that the Articles of Confederation that were in place, delegates were sent to the Constitutional Convention, which was not called the Constitutional Convention, to amend the Articles of Confederation, not rewrite a new constitution. Yet they locked the doors, and notes from that assembly, which rewrote the Articles of Confederation and the Constitution, were not made public for 53 years. 53 years it took for Madison's notes on what happened behind closed doors in that Constitutional Convention to become public. Okay. All that's in the history books. Popehead really has just taken it and put it together in a much different way. Richard tells a story to prefigure the democracy school to some extent. There's been an evolution of the folks within the program of corporations, law, and democracy. Essentially to pulling apart the corporation to coming to a point where they now say publicly that it's not about the corporation at all. It's about us. It's about what we want and what we need and what we're willing to do to get that. That's really the base or the root of where the program of corporation law and democracy has come. So we throw the word corporation around a lot, but at the same time, it's not about corporations at all. It's about what we want and what stands in our way of getting that. One of the things that stands in our way is these corporate constitutional rights and freedoms that don't allow us to get what we want for communities. Okay? And that's where Popeglad sits at this point. That's Popeglad's evolution. Now, to pick up the story with a phone call that I received when I was in law school. Richard Grossman made it a habit to call people up who was running for state office and to try to engage them about these ideas. I was in law school and I'd been talked into running for governor as a Green Party candidate. This was back in 1994. And Richard Grossman got me on the phone and started talking to me about some of these things, and I thought he was a nut. Because you get a lot of crazy calls when you run for office. People run for office know that. But the conversation stayed with me, because he was attempting to engage folks about some of these materials. In law school is a fascinating place for folks that have been. The old joke about law school is, you know, they vacuum your brain out and they fill it up with cheese whiz, which is essentially the process that folks go through. But when I went to law school, my graduating class was 220, 230 kids. Of those 230 kids, about three went to law school because they knew what they wanted to do, and it was public interest law. They wanted to help people to some extent. As we went through law school, you start to drop off those folks who look at their $150,000, $200,000 law debts and understand that public interest law doesn't pay enough to pay them back. And usually those folks go into a different type of occupation or a different area. My naivete about law school came to an end when your third year they start circulating memos from law firms that want to hire students from law school. And they put out these lists, and you can schedule an interview. You know, 2 o'clock, show up in room blank, and you can meet with this law firm. Yet nowhere on the list, when people go for interviews, does it say what kind of law you're going to practice. Okay. It's this meat market, you know, fit people here, plug them in there type of thing. They're looking for top 10%, an honor student, and we'll interview you. But nowhere on the sheet does it tell you what kind of law you're going to practice. Second year in law school, we began being approached by community organizations who needed legal representation on things like permit appeals. One of the first ones we handled illegally, because we were not bar certified at that point, was a group that came to us about an incinerator. It's an African-American organization, predominantly African-American neighborhood, who had a giant incinerator that had been operating. We had this thing called Mount Ashmore. It was this 200-foot pile of ash, a contaminated pile of ash that blew around the neighborhood. And they came to us looking for a lawyer because, as everybody in this room knows, lawyers, most lawyers, make really good money in the environmental field. The rates currently are between $250 and $450 an hour to hire an environmental attorney, not just to do a permit appeal, but to do an ordinance, a drafting of anything in the area of toxics or sludge or factory farms, those types of things. And so these folks were coming to us with a very simple request. They did not have the money to hire an attorney, and they were looking for someone to help them to appeal their permit or do the work that they had to do. And so a very small handful of us in law school began to assist these groups, even before we had graduated and had passed the bar. And it was that point that my first experience about framing the problem came into play, because I framed the problem at that point, which I've come to regret later, as not enough attorneys. there's not enough lawyers out there to assist these groups. The statistics are still quite startling. There are only 200 full-time public interest environmental lawyers in the United States. 200 full-time public interest environmental attorneys in the United States. So at that point, we said to ourselves, well, what we need to do is grow that by about 10%. And or less, and so we decided to create our own law firm. And the law firm that we created was called the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund. It's the same one that exists today that we do our work through. And we, in creating the Legal Defense Fund, we had one mission, which was to provide free legal help to these groups that couldn't afford legal services to do permit appeals and to do this other type of work. And so we jumped right in, and we started taking these permit appeal cases. And we got really good at it. We would go in front of an administrative law judge or an agency on behalf of a group against the corporation. Usually had been issued a permit. And as anybody who has ever been active in environmental issues knows, or in permit issues knows, that a permit application is filed. You know, it can be 1,000 pages or 500. You need your own expert sometimes to even understand what's in it. But when the permit application gets filed by the corporation, the reviewer at the agency sits down and they take the regulations on one side, which is a checklist, you know, 30 different items that have to be in the permit application. And they sit down and the permit application on the other side, and they run through it to make sure that the permit is administratively complete. Okay? That's the determination that they make before they issue the permit. Is everything there? If everything's there, we're going to issue the permit, assuming that there's no other testing that needs to be done or those types of things. One of the items in the regulatory chart might be, you know, a bond needs to be filed by the corporation to prevent erosion and sedimentation. Or to prevent water pollution, $10,000 bond needs to be put in place. We got really good at going in and arguing that the checklist hadn't been met. Your Honor, line 6, little I, little 2, 3, C, says that there needs to be a $50,000 bond posted. These guys only posted a $45,000 bond, so you have to throw the permit out. Or they had to do water testing. The water tests they use are from 94. They're too old. They're stale. You need to order them to do more testing to meet the administratively complete requirement for these regulations. And the judge would say, by gosh, you're right. It's only they didn't post enough of a bond. They didn't. These tests are stale. We're going to pitch this. Pitch the permit. Community group would invite us over for a victory party. You know, we'd meet at somebody's house, have a couple beers, have some food, have some fun, clap each other on the back. The group would say, you know, we had these cake and cookie sales. We raised a couple dollars to pay the expert and to do the photocopies and the gas. Thank you, Legal Defense Fund, for providing the legal counsel. This is wonderful. We won! We won! We got the permit kicked out. Everything's okay now. They have this little victory party. 3 months later, the corporation would come back. And the corporation would say to us, thank you very much. You identified the gaps and the omissions in our permit application. And we filled those now. We're resubmitting the permit application. And the community group would come to us and they'd say, we need your help again. Because originally, you know, community groups don't come to you and they say, we want you to help us regulate this incinerator better. They come to you and they say, we don't want it. Because our vision for our community does not include that thing. It doesn't include a 5,000 head hog factory farm. It doesn't include 500 tons of raw sewage being dumped in our farmland. It doesn't include this toxic waste incinerator that's being driven into this community. Being the good, liberal, traditional environmental lawyers that we were, we would walk in and say, well, you can't stop it really, but let's try to use the regulatory system to try to slow it down or stop it, because that's the only tools that we thought we had to use. And so when the corporation came back and said, thank you very much, here we were, a law firm set up to protect communities and the environment, and here we were actually being harnessed into a process whereby we were doing the work of the corporation for them. That was a pretty rude awakening to us, because we had gotten very good at permit appeals. Okay? We got so good at these things, we won a couple Pennsylvania Supreme Court cases, we won a bunch of decisions in front of regulatory hearing boards. We were even training people to do their own, which I thought was pretty cool. We would train groups to do oral argument and to write briefs. They were producing stuff that second-year law students, it was better than second-year law students were putting out in terms of legal briefs. And they were winning some, you know, setbacks for coal mining operations and sludge cases, those types of things. We were getting really good. We got the awards. We got the funding. We got an invitation to Al Gore's Environment Day at the White House. Yeah, we were being recognized. We were doing everything right. Okay? And it was because we were pretty much good little boys and girls operating within a regulatory structure that was pounding the crap out of the community groups, and we weren't stopping shit. We weren't stopping anything. Literally. We weren't stopping anything. And I think the straw that broke the camel's back, really, was a case in Virginia that we took where Governor George Allen had this bright idea of partnering with General Motors to build a new highway and put it smack dab in the middle of a historic and environmentally sensitive valley that was pristine and untouched. It was called Ellet Valley down near Roanoke, southwestern Virginia. We filed 4 lawsuits dealing with that case to try to stop that highway using the only tools that conventional environmental lawyers have. In this case, it was the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires you to do an environmental impact statement. We've all heard those freaking phrase, environmental impact statement. Well, people, especially environmental lawyers, make a living out of challenging environmental impact statements, like to say, oh, we have this vaunted environmental laws, these vaunted environmental laws in these United States. And you can use this tool, and our law schools, you know, they graduate all these environmental lawyers who are focused on the regulatory stuff and enforcing the National Environmental Policy Act and the environmental impact statements. Well, that's all a bunch of crap, because the environmental impact statement requirement within our national federal environmental laws, they're disclosure laws. They have no teeth to stop anything. They require an agency to disclose the type of damage that a project will cause. Disclose it. And as long as they disclose it, there's no way to stop it through the environmental impact statement process. Yeah. Filed 4 lawsuits, 2 appeals. 4th Circuit Court of Appeals sits in Virginia. I think one of them was so old he had an IV in his arm while he was sitting up at the bench. It's one of the most conservative circuit courts in the United States. Who, you know, they don't give 2 craps about whether this valley's going to go under or not. And so the final thing that turned me, someone who was, you know, gung-ho about regulatory stuff and blah, doing this and award funding and all that stuff, final thing, was when I was standing on the back of a pickup truck with a bullhorn shouting down the governor, George Allen, at the groundbreaking ceremony for the freaking road. And I remember looking across the fence. I was with 2 brave souls. I remember looking across the fence, and there on the other side were people in tuxedos drinking champagne. The corporate boys listening to George Allen's speech. It was at that point that I said to myself, the law is not on our side. The law is not on our side. And in fact, the law was never written to be on our side. Someone said to me back in the late 90s, I wish I remember who it was, stuck with me since now, till now, that the only thing that environmental regulations regulate is environmentalists. They make us predictable. We follow someone else's script. I've seen the compliance budgets for the corporate boys. They put line items in to deal with us. In the unlucky situation where they get a community group that they have to deal with. A lot of times the projects just go forward without it. But worse than that, the monies that they put into the budget, they're tax deductible. They're tax deductible. It's insane. So what happened after that, after my awakening in that sense? Well, we didn't have to wait too long because our phones started ringing off the hook in the office. And it started ringing off the hook with people that we had no idea how to help. It rang off the hook with municipal officials from some of the most rural communities in Pennsylvania, south central and north central Pennsylvania. We tell a joke about Pennsylvania. I was born in Alabama, so I can tell it. We have Pittsburgh on one side, Philadelphia on the other, and Mississippi in the middle.
I didn't know I was a Mississippian.
We do 90% of our work in Mississippi. Okay? And the phone, what started happening back in 1996, when our phones started ringing off the hook, this wasn't just 5 municipal governments, or 10, or 20, or 60. It was 400 municipal governments in Pennsylvania that had started contacting us. First couple that came in, we said, we can't help you. We don't know what to do. We weren't set up to service that constituency of local governments. We were set up to help community groups, not local governments. What were they calling about? Well, they were calling because corporate hog farms were invading rural Pennsylvania. And it wasn't enough that corporate hog farms, run by a handful of corporations, because, of course, close to 70% of all pork production in the United States is done by 4 corporations. 4 corporations, close to 70% of pork production. Wasn't bad enough that the factory farm corporations were invading rural Pennsylvania. It was that they had the help of the legislature to do it. Because that year was the year that the Nutrient Management Act was passed by the Pennsylvania legislature. I remember the signing. Governor stood there, right behind him, Sierra Club, a bunch of the traditional environmental organizations. Not to pick on the Sierra Club, because we work quite a bit with them now. Conventional, traditional environmental groups standing behind the governor. This is the first state to pass a Nutrient Management Act that will deal with the large amounts of liquid manure produced by farm operations. First state. Environmentally sensitive. That's why we're passing this thing through. Well, at midnight, when the bill was running, right before it was passed, They inserted, they, the corporate boys, we're going to refer to them often, inserted a provision into the Nutrient Management Act that preempted all local governments from passing manure disposal ordinances that were more stringent than the state law. Okay? Now, the state law is a free-for-all. There's no money for enforcement, even if there were. Regulations aren't written for the communities. They're written for the agribusiness folks, because that's who wrote them. Okay? So we didn't write them in the first place. These rural communities were turning to us. Why would rural communities turn to an environmental legal defense fund in the first place? Right? They were turning to us because everybody else had abandoned them, had cut the bonds to them. Because there was nowhere else for them to turn. They had angry citizens in the community saying, we don't want this 5,000 head hog factory farm coming into our community. And the state was saying, you're going to get it. You're going to get it because this law requires you to have it. Right? And these communities started saying, no, we're not going to do that. South Central and North Central Pennsylvania have been dumping grounds for decades. Philadelphia crap comes there. Literally. Gets dumped. Places like Schuylkill County.
New York crap.
New York crap, too. places nobody ever heard of. Schuylkill County, Clarion County, Franklin County, Fulton County, Juniata County, Huntington County. All these places, never been active before, but something started to shift. And the rest of the story about what happened with that shift, we're going to tell on Saturday afternoon. Because after all, if these communities had decided to fight it out over permit appeals and regulations, we wouldn't be teaching the democracy school. Right? Because something else has happened. And what's happened is so exciting, I get excited still, that it took the legislature 6 years to try to shut parts of it down. So when we say a corporate system, people ask us all the time, why did you choose to work with the smallest units of government in Pennsylvania? We didn't choose. It's the only thing left. Oh. It's the only thing left. Postlade used to talk about corporations being extensions of the state. Now we talk about the state being an extension of corporations. When we started doing this work, like I said before, we started getting phone calls about what's happening in Pennsylvania, how do we replicate it. People said, send me an email with a Word attachment with the ordinance in it that you passed in such and such township.
I did that. Yeah, me too.
You did that? And we had to explain to people that the product is not the ordinance. The product is not the piece of paper with the ordinance on it. The product is the number of people within those communities who are standing up to say, screw you. Mm-hmm. Whether that's the legislature, whether it's the Hatfield Corporation that wants to come in and stick one of these sons of bitches in. These people are serious. They're moving to new levels now with this home rule stuff. And that's what we're going to talk about tomorrow afternoon. For the democracy schools, we've been lucky enough to have Vicky, who's a longtime activist, in regulatory circles, to begin doing some work in a different vein, to be a certified lecturer for the Democracy School. I think her story is very important in this scheme. So, Vicki.
Well, I grew up in the Philadelphia area, moved to North Central Pennsylvania in 1981 with my family because we wanted a place that was more pristine to live in, and all of the good things that come with that. And right after we moved there, we found out that it really wasn't as pristine as we thought. And the first thing in the early 80s that I got involved with, before that I'd been somewhat involved with a nuclear power plant in Limerick, because I lived in that area. But when I got up to Lycoming County and near the Williamsport area, I actually live in a town called Jersey Shore, Pennsylvania, and
with a shore.
And we got involved for a few years with the anti-nuclear movement, with Sane Freeze and so forth, And then we took some time off. Like Jean, I have had a lifetime of taking sabbaticals from activist work as my children were growing up and I felt like I needed to be home, or later after my children left and I just felt like I needed a break to collect my own sanity. And then about in 1994, we found out that there was I work in the town of Lock Haven, and there was an old dye plant there that had made red dyes that go on the plastic tail lights of cars. That was basically what they made. They made some other things, but that was most of it. But it was extremely toxic. They had gone out of business. It became a Superfund site, and after many years, EPA got around to our site to clean it up, and what they wanted to do was put this new state-of-the-art incinerator right in downtown Lock Haven, in an area where there were four elementary schools, daycare centers, hospital, you know, the whole thing. And we just said, you know, this is not acceptable. And we went to the first dog and pony show that they held for the public, and we watched. My husband and I didn't really say too much. We just kind of watched what other people were doing and what the EPA was giving back, which was basically nothing. And when people asked good questions, the response was always, well, we didn't bring that person with us, so we'll get back to you on that one. And I'm sure you've heard that. So we went from that meeting to the person who seemed to be the ringleader, and we said, you know what? We need to organize this community. We can't just be asking questions and not have a foundation here. We need to do some organizing. So we organized a group called AIR, Arrest the Incinerator Remediation. And from 1994 until 1998, when the incinerator stopped burning because it was finished, we fought a very hard battle. We had meetings once a week, every week for those years. We went to every dog and pony show that we could. We tried the educational route with educating, with leafleting, door knocking on doors. We tried the legislative route. We tried the legal route. We went to court. We raised a lot of money. We did, oh my God, we did so much fundraising. I got so tired of fundraising. We just did the whole thing. And every turn we went to, we were defeated. And finally, we took it to court, and we went to our Third Circuit Court in Williamsport, and they told us that we didn't have standing there because the company, Waste Management, that was doing this incinerator was actually an Ohio company, so we had to go to federal court because they were not a Pennsylvania corporation. So then we had to refile all over again in federal court, and then that went to a three-judge appeals court, which then later went to an en banc hearing, which was the entire court in Philadelphia. And they took so long to make their decision, they finally decided that, and the question at that point was only, did we have standing? We didn't even get to hear to present the merits of the case. This was 4 years of legal battling based on whether or not we had standing to bring a suit. And they finally decided that, yes, we had standing 2 weeks before the incineration cleanup was completed. Now, of course, it wasn't really cleaned up because they didn't do it the way they should have done it, and they only went 12 feet deep instead of the 37 feet of contamination that they knew was there, and all these other things that I won't bore you with because I have a feeling that many of you already know exactly what I'm talking about. But it did exactly what it was supposed to do. It wore us out following the regulatory path of all of the things that what we had to do next. Okay, now we failed here, we have to do that. Now you did this, you have to get an EPA grant. You can get a technical assistance grant for $50,000 so that you can hire your own experts so that they can interpret what the EPA rulings are. So we did that. We wrote a grant. We jumped through all of the EPA's hoops. Then we got an extended grant for another $50,000 a year or two later. because it was still ongoing. And then we got a third EPA grant for another $30,000 to wrap things up. And I now have a room in my barn that holds probably 15 filing cases, maybe more, of documents that I have to keep for 10 years from 1998 was when that stopped. And I have to keep those records in my barn for 10 years. And, you know, if anybody ever wants to see them, at this point they have mouse droppings and bird droppings and all kinds of other things on them, and I'd be glad to just give them back to EPA that way. But basically, we banged our head against the wall for years. It took away my family life. My children were in their mid and upper teens at the time. They resented the time away from home that it took us. They never understood that we thought that we were doing this for them. You know, there were social gatherings that we missed doing because we were too busy being activists. There were friends that are no longer our friends because they got tired of hearing our rap. You know, so all of these things are things that affect you when you play this regulatory game. And we didn't really understand that we couldn't win it. We always kept thinking, you know, next meeting we'll get an extra 100 people out. Next time we'll get 1,000 more signatures on this petition. We just kept thinking that if we did it better, we would do a better job and we would win. And there's something called, that I've learned after working with the Democracy School, random positive reinforcement that kept us going. Because as our battle was continuing, we were introduced to the Pennsylvania Environmental Network, and then my husband and I both became board members on that, so then we had not only our own battle, but other people's battles around the state to deal with. And once in a while, people do win. And it's that once in a while that keeps your hope alive. That's what kept us going. And even if the win is not a permanent win, like Tom was saying, you might win for 3 months and then they're back, but there's that hope is there. So we kept it up. The only thing that we managed to do through all of that effort was to change a few small things in the design of the incinerator, that there was a thermal release valve that they weren't working right, and we made them change that. You know, big deal. Our community still got plastered with all kinds of nasties. And I work in social service also. I'm a speech therapist. I work in early intervention. I do Head Start children. I do children in their homes, or in their granny's house, or at the babysitter's, or at the daycare center, 3 to 5 year olds. And so that gave me a way to really be in touch with what was happening exposure-wise. And my practice saw so many children with problems that we had not seen before. An increased incidence in cleft palate, an increased incidence of children with absolutely severe behavior issues by the time they were 3 years old, children with severe learning disabilities, several cases of a rare thing called brittle bone disease were happening in our community after this incinerator started. You know, and the numbers of cancers increasing in children and adults. This the plant that was contaminated used beta-naphthalamine a lot, and that is the leading cause of bladder cancer. And Lock Haven, Pennsylvania, Clinton County, Pennsylvania, had the highest incidence of bladder cancer in the country. All of the people who worked at this place before it shut down are now dead, all of them. There's not a single living person that worked in this plant. So we lost that one. But just as that was winding down, 2 weeks before the incinerator stopped its burning, Three blocks away, the International Paper Company decided that they were going to start a win-win-win situation, and they were going to burn 90 tons of tires a day, chipped tires, for energy. So we thought, my God, we can't let that go away. So we got interested in that, and my husband, bless his soul, he fought that pretty much on his own. The air group was pretty well burnt out at that time after all of those years of weekly meetings, but we had some money left. So they all said, well, Bill, if you want to take this on, use the rest of the money from air and do what you can do. And we were working with an attorney, Mick Harrison, at that time, and Mick said he would help Bill do it. And actually, it came down to Bill writing briefs. Tom helped him some. But Bill fought this case in our Department of Environmental Protection has a kangaroo court. I forget what they call it.
Environmental Hearing Board.
Yeah, the Hearing Board, Environmental Hearing Board. And he spent about a year fighting that case and losing. And he and Mick went down to Harrisburg for the 4 days of this hearing, shared a $35 a night hotel room, budget hotel, while the whole team of lawyers from DEP and from International Paper and from the company that wanted to do that had the tires, which was a mafia-owned company, all gathered together in the highest-priced hotel in Harrisburg, and wined and dined all over. And our guys were like running back and forth to Kinko's copiers to get, you know, 1,000 copies of this made to hand out to all their legal team. And it was crazy. It made us crazy. And during the time that we became involved with the Pennsylvania Environmental Network, at one point I became president of that. But because of that, we met Tom, who was the legal advisor for Penn. And I heard Tom's rap many times, and I kept thinking, you know, I never heard the democracy school thing, but I heard what Tom was doing, and I saw Tom's evolution through some of the things that he just told you about, and it all seemed very interesting to me, but I was an activist who believed that you had to go the regulatory route, so I couldn't get it out of my mind that there was another way to think outside this box. It took a long time, and Tom has told me since that longtime activists are the hardest people to convince of this. And maybe that's why these folks in the center of Pennsylvania who are having their rednecks and their shit kickers were easier, because they didn't have all of these preconformed conceptions to get through. We did. We just thought, well, we can't just drop what we're doing in the middle of this. We have to do this. We have to understand what this chemical is going to do to this amount of the population, and, you know, on and on and on. We just really thought we had to play that game. But I'm tired of playing it. And so I got into a different game, in part because of Tom. I ran for lieutenant governor of Pennsylvania. It was a way to get a message out. I ran as a Green. It was the first time. Tom, I didn't know that you ran for governor. Sorry. Let me say then that it was the first really concerted effort to put forth a statewide slate of candidates. And we did not do a very good job. We got 1.1% of the vote. But we were visible all over the state. And I don't regret doing it. I would not ever do it again. But, you know, that was another part of my evolution. And after that was in 2002, November election, my husband and I both just kind of collapsed for about 6 months and learned how to breathe again. And then in June of 2003, we went to the first one of our democracy schools. So I've attended 3 or 4 democracy schools, I think, and you get so much information this weekend, and it takes so much to sink in. And the policy that was in effect, I hope still is, is that if you've attended one democracy school, you can come back to others without paying tuition, only paying the room and board fees.
That applies just for Wilson.
Okay.
These folks have to decide. But, yeah.
At any rate, I did that, and that's why we went back. And it took me, I don't know whether it's my age or my biases or what, but even with that, it took me the second or third or fourth democracy school before I really started to get it. And it is an adventure, but it's just the beginning of the adventure. So hang on, folks. Hold on to your seats, because I think this is really exciting stuff. And it really gives me, for the first time in 20 years, some hope that, things can change.
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy School with instructor Thomas Lindsay of the Community Legal Environmental Defense Fund. It took place last weekend in Steuben County, New York. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, or WRFN Nashville. And stay tuned, because later in the program, I'm going to tell you how to bring a democracy school to your community. For now, we continue with Thomas Lindsay.
I got really tired of hearing some people saying that the regulatory system is broken. In a way, in many ways, the regulatory system isn't broken at all. It's doing exactly what it was intended to do. The Interstate Commerce Commission, the ICC, which was the first regulatory agency in the United States, was actually conceived by the big railroad companies to put the little railroad companies out of business. That's what the ICC was all about. So regulatory agencies have a mission, a purpose, and so when I hear that broken stuff, it really doesn't fly with me anymore. The other thing is, we had a psychiatrist who worked with battered women, battered women's shelter, who took the democracy school a little while ago. I think it was number 31 or 33, somewhere in there. And she saw a lot of resonance with this clinging to the regulatory system with some of the stories that she had gone through about battered women returning home. In other words, trying to make something work that obviously wasn't working. And there's a theory, it actually has a name in psychological psychiatry circles. It's called the theory of learned helplessness.
Yeah.
That's what it's called. And so we spent about an hour on the theory of learned helplessness in the democracy school. I thought that was fascinating, because there's a lot of parallels. And the final piece is that I started giving talks last year. I get in trouble for them, depending on what the audience is, where one of the opening lines is that we've never had an environmental movement in this country. We've never had an environmental movement in this country because movements drive rights into the Constitution. Movements drive rights into fundamental frameworks of governance. We've never attempted to drive the rights of nature into the Constitution, okay, into fundamental frameworks of governance. What would that look like if ecosystems had rights, if forests had rights, if rivers had rights? In Pennsylvania, these home rule charters are going to be writing in the rights of nature. That, to me, is probably the most exciting stuff, the cutting-edge type of work, is what does that mean, and what does it look like when we use the law to do what this planet needs, what we want, what our communities need, those types of things. That, I think, is very exciting. We're going to start out with a piece called Smithfield Says State Miscounted the Extent of Its Water Pollution. We pulled this story out of our files in putting together the Democracy School curriculum, and it's fascinating when you pull these things out, because a couple years later you go back to them and you see things that you didn't see, and that's why one of the reasons why we still include this piece.